Thanks for joining us today. This is your host, Mags, and on the other end of the line, direct from Wisconsin, I have with me Mr. Carter Hayes. How's it going?
Hey, Mags, how's it going?
I'm not too bad. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
First off, I've always wanted to know, where's your screen name from?
So, the screen name. Screen name comes from a Michael Keaton film called Pacific Heights. One of my favorite films, kind of an underrated 90s tension horror flick. That's Keaton's title character's name. He's a guy that rents a flat from a house in Pacific Heights and slowly drives the yuppie homeowners insane with all kinds of different things, like growing cockroaches in his apartment. He's trying to get control of the property. So I thought it was the backstory is that he doesn't really have a past or a history, and so I thought that was a applicable thing for use on the internet in, 2006 or whenever I started hanging around. Probably earlier than that, I guess. Mm-hmm. Hanging around the old basement.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my next questions, was how long have you been around? Because I have trouble remembering a time when you weren't around.
Yeah, I think I've been around probably since I got back from Iraq, so that would put us like late 2004, early 2005, sometime in there. And then, that sounds about right.
Do you remember?
I was reading Lehman before that, and I think Twins Geek, and I think that's probably how I came across.
I think that's a common way for most people to find it. Do you remember where it was hosted? Was that still Blogspot at that point, or Blogger, whatever it was? Or had we had the, or was Stick doing his cobbled together couple hours in the basement site by then?
The first site layout that I remember was that terrible kind of peachish pink background.
Oh, the sepia is what, yeah. I think it was supposed to be. Yeah, that's an old one.
Yeah. So, far enough back now that I can't actually even remember. And I was actually thinking today, as I was thinking about some things that we might talk about, and I think the last time I saw you was at the convention. No, the only time that I've seen you, actually.
Yeah, the
6 years ago now?
The inaugural convention was that the summer after I graduated college? So it would have been 07? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it's been a while. But, yeah, you and the missus weren't yet married. You were still... Were you even engaged at that point, or just dating?
Let's see. That convention was...
I'm going to pull up my...
Already in the summertime. So, sometime between late June and August.
I'm going to pull up the photo album and see if I've got, a picture taken date on it. See if we can't dig up something solid. Because I remember we sat up in the upper deck and...
Mm-hmm. Yep. We had two rows.
Yep.
We had two rows.
And you...
Will and Stick sat together in the second row with... maybe Sheenie was with Will at that point already. I don't know if she came to the game or not.
She didn't come to the first one. She came to the second one, but I don't think you were at that one.
No.
That was the one where we met at the... we met at the park and grilled out a little.
Right.
Let's see. So I've got the... I've got... Oh, here's the picture of you and the missus with Stat Freak on the other side of her.
Yeah, Stat Freak 101, man.
Yeah, let's see.
I've been to a game with Stat Freak. That's an honor that few of us among the citizenry.
Photo details taken 9/27 or 9/28/07. So
September. Yeah, we would have been engaged by that point. She would have just moved up to Madison.
Mm-hmm.
She was living down in Chicagoland that summer and moved up in August, so she'd been here maybe a month.
Let's see, who else was there? There was you, me, and...
Stick, your friend Q was there.
Yep, Q was there. Here we go.
Yeah, Aaron was there.
Aaron, Gleeman, Stick, you, Q, Stat Freak, Will, Young was there, Scott was there.
Yes,
with,
Scott was there.
And he had his newborn.
Mm-hmm. Moss showed up at Hubert's, but I don't think he sat with us.
No, he didn't come to the game with us. And then John and Kyle, and they were from...
They were from Game Day.
Yeah, Game Day sent... They were ambassadors or something like that. They brought us programs at the bar, and then they sat with us.
Yep.
So that... I forgot about this. The Dread Pirate has his autographed Matthew Lecroy is my non-sexual man crush t-shirt on.
Yeah, he did wear that.
Yeah. So that was against the White Sox. Let's see.
The funny thing is, I don't remember who won.
Me either. I was just going to put in 2007 Twins into Baseball Reference.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a picture of, I assume, it says Owens stealing second. That wouldn't be Micah Owens. He was still in the National League at that point, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Scott Baker pitched, and I have a picture of Nick Punto batting, probably because Kyle got that number 8 painted on his face. .922 is...
Would that have been Jerry Owens?
Oh, here's the box score. The Twins lost 8-3.
Oofta.
I can't say that again. Yeah, it is Jerry Owens, leading off, playing center field.
Wow.
And it looks like his stolen base attempt I took a picture of is...
Starting center fielder.
Yeah, the picture I took, he was safe at second, it looks like. Jerry Owens. Oh, he's got...
Relatively late in the season game, too. I'm sure the lineup must have been really impressive.
129 games for Jerry Owens over 4 years. 2006, 8 and 9, he played 12 games each. And then 07, he had 93. And then, so yeah, we caught his one good year. I can't believe you remembered his name.
Well, I was trying to remember if it was... I knew it was a J, and I was like, it can't be Jayhawk Owens, because he played in like the mid-90s or something like that.
But
so
we've got Jerry Owens, Josh Field, Jim Thome, DHing, Canerico cleaning up, Erstad, Brzezinski, Juan Uribe, Danny Richer? I don't know how to pronounce that. I want to say it in a French accent, but I'm sure that's wrong. And then Alex Gonzalez and Javi Vazquez started.
That's a pretty respectable lineup.
And the Twins, Tyner leading off, Kubel DH, Torrey in center, Justin Morneau, Kadir, Brian Buescher, Chris Hines catching, Luis Rodriguez, and Nick Punto at short.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah, that's not as respectable. Scott Baker pitched, relieved by Boof Bonzer, Julio DePaula, Glenn Perkins, and John Corner himself, Juan Rincon.
Yeah. Who's the guy that has the DePaula jersey in the citizenry set? That's not AMR.
Right? It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Because I have a picture from the next convention at the Falls. He's got that on, and I've got my Lou Ford jersey. And somebody else had a really random jersey that year too. But I think that, and I haven't been to a convention since, because I was out of the country or living not as
you've been
convenient.
You've been out of
walkabout
for a while.
Well, better now than while I'm young, I can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
But
true enough.
Have you been overseas much on holiday, or just when the military sent you?
I've been over a couple of times.
Oh, you've been to Russia, of course.
Yeah, I went to Russia last year with my best friend. And before I was in the Marines, I went to France twice, and on one of those trips also went through Switzerland and spent some time in Italy.
That's cool. Those are four countries I've not been to, unless you count being stranded at Charles de Gaulle for a night.
That airport is the armpit of the world. The worst airport in the world, I think.
At least from personal experience, it's probably number one on my list, too. I'm sure there's some somewhere in the Amazon where you're lucky there's a runway, but at least in, you know...
In terms of international airport.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that has to be the worst. I mean, you probably, where else have you been through in Europe? Probably Schiphol, a fair amount.
No, actually, I've never been. Most of my, well, when I was going back and forth to Dublin a lot, Aer Lingus flies direct from O'Hare.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, no connections there. Dublin's a decent airport, and they just built a beautiful new terminal.
That's Shannon, isn't it?
Shannon's outside Limerick on the west coast of Ireland.
Alright. That's where we threw on the way back from.
My brother-in-law went through there on his way back from Afghanistan, too, last month. But, yeah, Shannon's not as busy, so I think a lot of the military transports go through there.
Makes sense.
And if people do fly, it's like I've done that flight. It's like 35 minutes. I think the pilot guns it off the runway and coasts into Dublin. They don't reach full altitude or anything.
Real puddle jumper flight, huh?
Essentially, yeah. But
well, I mean, the island's only so big. I mean,
you
take off and get any kind of altitude, and you're gonna miss the other side.
Mm-hmm. When we were there on vacation, we went from Enniskillen in the north down to Cork City, and it's like a 4.5 hour drive, and that's on what essentially are state highways or smaller. Like if there was a interstate, it would take probably 3.
And so you're talking like 4-lane or 2-lane, essentially.
Yeah, something. You know, there's not a big, like a direct I-35 or something. Yeah. But I was telling my Irish friends, like, you drove all the way from, you know, up there down to Cork? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I was literally twice as big as Ireland, so that drive is nothing to me. Minnesota's even larger than that. Wisconsin's gonna probably be twice as big as, you know, they just...
You drive 4 hours north from where I grew up, you're just in the middle of the state, you know. You're not even... when I was a kid, my parents divorced when I was little, and my dad moved to a small village in western Wisconsin, and my mom and stepdad, after my stepdad and she graduated from college, they got teaching jobs up in Thief River Falls, which is about 60 miles south of the Canadian border.
Mm-hmm.
And every 3 weeks, my folks would make that drive halfway each to basically exchange me custody-wise, so we'd always meet up in St. Cloud, you know? And so they did 4 hours in one direction and 4 hours back the other way to home, and I did the whole 8. Essentially, I think is what it worked out to, 8 or 8.5.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, 4 hours north to south in Ireland. Yeah, that doesn't get you too very far. It doesn't. I suppose if you laid that across Iowa, that puts you somewhere in the middle of the state too, huh?
Yeah. When we go to from my parents' house to southern Indiana to my grandparents, it's depending on which way you go, it's between 10 and 12 hours, and the first 5.5 or just getting out of Iowa in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, scales are much different over there in terms of distance anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I've been through Dublin a lot, Heathrow a couple times.
What about when you were living in Prague? Did you get a direct flight there, or did you go through, like, Frankfurt or something?
When I went over the first time, I flew direct from JFK to Prague. And then the second time, I went through Heathrow.
Mm.
And because using British Airways, I could fly into on a code share and get into Des Moines for relatively cheap, which is a pretty good deal. Like, because Des Moines is usually not a cheap airport to travel in and out of, but it was something like 30 extra bucks instead of flying out of O'Hare. I was like, for $30, definitely. Because my main...
You can't beat the to a larger airport for that.
Yeah, my main MO is usually have my parents drop me in Des Moines, or while I was living there, just get dropped downtown, take the megabus to Chicago, stay overnight with my old roommate, and then take the blue line out to O'Hare, which... It's annoyingly convoluted, but
It gets you there.
It's usually, even if you factor in what your time's worth, it's cheaper than getting a flight out of Des Moines. Several times I've looked at flights to go to Ireland, and the Des Moines to Chicago flight comprises half the trip cost. It's, you know, I can fly the 2,000, 3,000 miles to Dublin to Chicago for the same price as the 45-minute flight to Des Moines, just because domestic flights are so expensive in the States.
They really are. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons we're lucky. My mother-in-law lives down in Chicagoland, so we have the option, essentially, of driving down there and getting her to drive us into O'Hare Midway, or we can go up to the cities, and I've got an uncle that lives up there, and we could always probably either catch a cab to the airport or get a ride over there if we wanted to do that, so we can look at fares from there, and usually it's a lot less expensive, but... I get the sense that you probably travel a fair bit more than we do. We maybe take a trip once every couple of years or something like that.
Yeah, I was doing a lot more traveling a couple of years ago, but haven't had the, what do you call them, discretionary funds for a whirlwind adventure lately.
Yeah. But you're in Maryland now, right?
Northern Virginia.
Northern Virginia?
Yeah. Okay.
We were just out there in September for a wedding. Probably not an area that we would have chosen to visit when we did.
Especially not that time of year. It gets pretty swampy, muggy around here.
We got lucky, and the weather was decent the whole time we were out there. The unfortunate thing was that the Orioles weren't in town, so we didn't get a chance to go see them. But that meant that we had time to do downtown Baltimore and go out to Fort McHenry and get stuck in Ravens traffic on the way back and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I remember seeing your Fort McHenry pictures on your blog.
Yeah, that's right. I posted those.
Yeah, they had this Saturday, the Ravens and the Redskins were both home, and they were predicting bad weather, so that there were announcements on the news and stuff just... Don't leave the house Sunday afternoon if you don't have to, because the Beltway is just going to be ridiculous. But luckily, I'm
over here nodding like you can see me, but yeah. I would be going anywhere.
No. Luckily, I'm far enough on the west edge of things. I'm out on the other side of Dulles that like game day traffic doesn't affect me.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But, I was on the Beltway Saturday morning at, 6:30 in the morning, and I was just thinking, there is no way you could pay me enough to be driving this every morning.
I don't know how people do it. I mean, I know DC has pretty decent public transportation. I think that would be pretty high on my priority list to be able to leverage that instead of having to sit in traffic over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took the metro into the city 2 weeks ago or something, and I did the park and ride, and because I didn't want to drive all the way downtown, and as far as, you know, comparatively, I've heard the metro get a bad rap around here, but it wasn't terrible, at least not my experience. We'll go ahead and label that small sample size, though.
Yeah, well, I think the DC metro is a substantial bit better than a fair number of the ones that I've ridden in this country, anyways. You know, and for the ridership that they probably have, they're doing fairly well. I don't know how well they maintain it. I know Chicago's really, really sweating that infrastructure stuff right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All your from Chicago friends are, you know, this or that problem with the CTA and, you know.
Yeah, I hear a lot of quite a few delays on my commute. Like on the traffic reports, they'll say red lines down between two stations. I don't know where they are, but it seems like a couple times a week somebody's at least delayed. But I'm sure Yikit could shed more light on that subject. He's been here for quite a few years now.
Yeah, he's been out there for a good while.
Because we both graduated Drake in 07, and then he came out here for law school. So I don't know if he came straight away or he took a year off between. But he's been out here for, I'm guessing, at least 5 years? I'd have to ask him myself.
That sounds right to me. I mean, I think going back to the old basement. He'd been out there for maybe a year or something like that before we had the transition.
And then Dread Pirate, he went to school out here too, so.
Yeah, GW.
Yep. I'm talking to him hopefully sometime later in the week. And then.
You've got a bunch of these lined up, huh?
You too.
Oh, okay. And then the trio thing that we might be doing here.
Yeah, we'll see if we can find a time convenient for everybody. Get more of a round table going.
Yeah. Did we just spoil ourselves?
I can always edit it out. But yeah, the podcast took off like a bang like 2 years ago while I was bored having coming back from Prague, and then I ended up going back, and then with the time differences I couldn't do anymore. So
yeah.
Hopefully now we can get a semi-decent stream built back up, because Spooky and I interviewed each other, I don't know, in August, and then let it die again, so going to try and keep...
One of the things that really excites me about this is that I have this thing where, you know, I don't listen to a lot of radio. I listen to a fair number of podcasts, but the radio I do listen to is, for the most part, NPR. So, you know, I grew up listening to Minnesota Public Radio or NPR, and when you don't have the ability to see what the person behind the microphone looks like, you kind of conjure this image. And one of the reasons why I'm excited about the podcast series that you're going to be doing is we've got the avatars, and then we get to hear the voice. And we're at the point now where, you know, through Facebook or through pictures that we all post on the site, we kind of get a chance to see what each other looks like. But it's still a little bit of that, you know, here's the voice, and then here's the online avatar that we're used to thinking about, and putting the two of those together and getting to have a fuller sense of someone's personality that maybe isn't evident just because it's on the screen.
Yeah, more three-dimensional look at the people. Yeah. Because like we were saying during the pledge drive lately, it's kind of weird how close we all are, friendship-wise, without not really meeting in a lot of cases, or knowing what each other look like, even. And I definitely agree that this is going to help form.
You know, and there's the cadre of guys that are located around the cities and see each other, you know, semi regularly,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a little bit more often than that, depending. And I think for those of us living out further away from the, I don't know if that's considered the epicenter anymore. It used to, I guess we could consider it the old epicenter of the old basement.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of neat to have the other connections like this one, or to hear people say, you know, in the pledge drive, like, this is my other place, or you know, to have that sense of community like we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that thing that brought us all together in the first place was the twins. So how did you, I assume you got into the twins because you grew up in the, you know, local broadcast area. How did it, how did it not be the Brewers?
Well, because my dad and my mom are both from Minnesota. Actually, the interesting thing is that, so my grandfather also grew up in Minnesota, same, we all have the same hometown. But of course the twins weren't around when he was growing up. So when he was really young, he followed the Dodgers back when they were in Brooklyn. And then when the Braves moved to Milwaukee, he became a Milwaukee Braves fan and followed the Braves until he joined the Navy. He was out in San Diego for the real tail end of the Pacific Coast League. He was stationed out there and, you know, did some trips overseas and that kind of thing. But remained loyal to the Braves, and, you know, for the first, I guess, 4 years, the Twins were in Minnesota, followed both teams, and then the Braves moved. And so the Twins' loyalty is what stuck, and that's what got passed down. And then, you know, I suppose the Braves, or the Brewers and the Twins, when I was little, they were both good teams. You know, that was the Yount, Molitor, Cecil Cooper, Gorman Thomas, Teddy Higuera. Brewers, a pretty decent team. But because we had that Twins loyalty, you know, that's who we stuck with. My dad's favorite player at the time was Gaetti, and you know, so that was the group of guys that I grew up with watching. And we got the Twins on KWNO out of Winona when the weather was good, and when the weather was bad or at night, sometimes we could pull in CCO better than KWNO, just because of the weird way that the bluffs work down there. So that's who we'd listen to. So, you know, Herb Carneal, even before John Gordon, was really the nexus of baseball for me. And in those early building towards 87 teams, you know, where I was really little, but, you know, because all those guys were my dad's age, those were the guys that we talked about. You know, it wasn't, you know, even people just a little bit earlier than that. John Castino or somebody like that would have been maybe just a little bit older than my dad, whereas Herbeck, Gaetti, those guys were his age. It's kind of weird, like, you know, Maurer is a year younger than I am or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's weird thinking about, there are baseball players who are on the downside of their primes that are my age, you know, and thinking about what that must have been like for my dad in the mid-80s and watching that team get built. You know, McPhail put those teams together and then go to two World Series. You know, that's not an experience that I'm going to have, but I can sort of remember what it was like for him. So, yeah, my earliest favorite player on the Twins that I can remember was Mickey Hatcher, which is sort of an atypical thing, and I think it had something to do with a baseball card that I had that I got attached to or something like that. And pretty soon, you know, as with probably every kid who started following the Twins in the 80s, since my age, you know, Kirby Puckett was the be-all, end-all. But Mickey Hatcher was my first Twins love, I guess.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I don't have those same, you know, Herbeck, Gaetti memories because I didn't move to Iowa till 98. And so that's one of the things I
suppose you're attached to, like the Indianapolis Indians or something.
Oh, definitely. We used to get it was a package called the Knothole Gang, and it was like something cheap, like $10 a year, and you got a T-shirt and it had kids looking through knot holes in a fence watching a ball game. And, like, free admission all year. It was...
Is that at, what was it, Busch Stadium?
It was... The old Busch Stadium was... Yeah. We moved in 98, and I remember Victory Field opening. I remember the farewell season for Busch. I think it was 96. I think we lived there for a year for Victory Field in 97, and we moved. Well, Busch
being turned into apartments now.
That's the latest I've heard too. At first, it was a dirt track for like go karts, or not go sprint cars. Whatever the ones with the funny wings on the roof are.
Sprint cars. Yeah, and they only turn basically in one direction, and they basically are 45 degrees to the track.
Yeah, so that's just a. Extended power slide, it looks like to me.
Yeah.
And then
a lot of that's more common with old ballparks than I had ever realized. You'd read about some of the old Negro League parks and the same thing happened.
And then then Busch was a repository for cash for clunker cars. They just crammed them. There's aerial shots, they're just crammed in there. All over the field. It's weird. And then now it's being redeveloped to condos.
Yeah, sort of sounds like what they were for a while intending to do with Tiger Stadium in Detroit, where there might be like a little park area for neighborhood kids to play ball or something like that, right? And then the rest of it's all, you know, converted condo units with quasi-historical value.
The coolest part of Busch Stadium that I remember was if you came in the gate behind home plate, up on the facade Not outside the stadium, but like in the, I suppose you call it like the entryway. There was probably 10, 12-foot murals, hand-painted, of all the great Reds that had come up through Indianapolis. There was Tony Perez and Ken Griffey Sr. And I wish I had a picture of. And then there was seven or eight of them, and then I remember they added Razor Shines. They gave him a portrait towards the end of his career.
Would Barry Larkin have come through there?
Yeah, Barry Larkin came through. He didn't get a mural, but oh yeah, Barry was always destined for Cincinnati. I've talked to my dad about that, because he grew up in Southern Indiana during the Big Red Machine, so he grew up a Reds fan, and then through my entire childhood, from what I remember, they were the Reds farm team. Right around the time I was born, they were the Expos farm team, though, but I don't have those memories. But Randy Johnson, Larry Walker, Andres Galarraga, they all came through Indianapolis at one point.
Yeah, those Expos teams are so good.
But I think Barry Larkin came through. I remember Aaron Boone came through. Pokey Reese, he was
Oh, Pokey Reese.
my second favorite. Well, after Razor retired, he was my new favorite. Pokey Reese was. So when I say second favorite, I mean second in succession, not number two. But yeah, Aaron Boone came up through Indianapolis, and I remember seeing Brett there on a rehab assignment, because they were making a big deal how they were getting to play together. But yeah, all those.
Doing the brothers thing.
And I remember a couple other players. And then after a while, they went.
Sean Casey might have come through there.
I'm sure he would have. Oh, I don't remember him personally. But yeah, but Razor was always. He has something like, I don't know, 60 major league, not even 60 major league at bats. I think it's only like, no, he batted 60, I think. He has like one hit in 12 at bats or something awful. I don't know, I gotta look it up now. I remember he appeared in, but yeah, he made the majors, but never stuck. He was definitely a 4A player. So he was in Indianapolis for a huge chunk of his career, so he was like a local legend. Razor Shines, 88 plate appearances over 4 years, 15 hits, career batting average 185, career on base 239. So he did steal a base,
That's
though.
pretty bad even for the early 80s.
But oh, we loved him in Indianapolis. He was the best. I have a Razor Shines bobblehead at my parents' house.
Oh, that's terrific.
It's
Man, don't let the milkman know your parents' address.
yeah. That was one of the first things I ever said to him was, "Holy shit, is that Razor Shines in your avatar?"
I don't even remember the explanation behind that one. Maybe when you post this, he'll refresh my memory in the comments.
Yeah. Spooky, we're asking you nicely. Please re-explain yourself. We've both forgotten that story.
Well, heck, and if that was something that he told 5, 6 years ago, there are new folks around that have never heard the story. They might as well.
Right, yeah. Let me rephrase the question. CH and I aren't old and senile and forgetful. It's for the benefit of the new people.
There we go.
Yeah.
There we go.
So who's your favorite current twin then?
I'm not sure I have one. And this is the weird thing, and it sort of gets back to what I was talking about with Mauer being roughly the same age, and that I don't know if it had something to do with when I left for boot camp, which was right after the 2002 season ended. I guess I left. I showed up in boot camp December 2nd, but I'd been working in a bar in Winona. Actually a bar that I think Hungry Joe and I have both spent time in at one point. But I was working in this bar for the playoffs, and you know, remember sitting there after my shift watching the games out on the West Coast. And shortly after that, you know, I basically dropped out for 2 years. I had my folks sending me, you know, news when I was in boot camp and the off-season moves, and then trying to follow things, but, you know, deployed in 2004, didn't have much of a chance to follow things, and so I never really developed a connection to, you know, Morneau, who would have been coming up at that time. I suppose that was the end of the Minkiewicz, United Nations infield, that kind of stuff. So I never really picked up a connection to this current group, I guess, that has lasted through 2011, 2012. And now with this new group, some of these young guys, I'm excited about them. But I'm not sure if I have a favorite yet. You know, I was kind of excited about Hicks because of what at first looked like plate discipline, and then eventually became, you know, is this guy just overmatched? And yes, obviously this guy is now, or was overmatched. But I was excited about sort of the profile that he was bringing to the team. You know, I'm excited about Brian Dozier, just because it seems like, other than Chuck Knobloch and, you know, 1 year of Luis Castillo and 1 year of Todd Walker, second base has been a black hole for the Twins since, you know, John Castino played there for a year or something like that, back in the 80s. So I'm a little excited about having even a league average second baseman, which is kind of a metaphor for Twins fans in general, I guess, in the last 20 years. But yeah, I don't know that I have a favorite. I haven't bought a jersey of anybody for quite some time. I bought a couple for my wife. She's from Chicagoland, and so had the benefit of having the Jim Thome years at least in her ear for a good while there. And so Thome, and then when Thome moved on, she kind of latched on to Willingham. So she kind of likes the trundling gentleman slugger, I guess.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, this maybe gets into one of the things that I thought about, thought we might talk about. But yeah, I have guys that I'm excited about. I'm excited about what Arcia might be able to do. I'm reservedly excited about Pinto, you know. But I don't think I have a favorite.
What about you? Oh, well, I think it's required that I like Joe Mauer. Since I was, you know, actually around, I don't have an excuse like you do.
You like the singles hitting catchers, huh?
Hey, he gets on base. It's not his fault nobody else drives him around. He's not gonna steal his way around to third. That's for damn sure.
If he could do that as a catcher, that's inner circle.
Definitely, but
Mauer's great. I mean, you know.
But yeah, oh yeah. There haven't been too many bright spots to... I tend to... And this is going to your kind of... What archetype do I... I kind of like the Lou Fords, your kind of Razor Shineses, the guys who are getting by on not much, and even then, just barely. Mm-hmm. So... I always have an affinity for a fourth outfielder or something. I think that just reflects on my playing experiences. You know,
I kind of wonder if the people that we gravitate towards as players are the best version of the player that we were as you know, youths.
Mm-hmm.
That might not be the case at all, but I do wonder if there's something to recognizing yourself, a little tiny, underdeveloped piece of yourself, or, you know, impossible piece of yourself in a player.
Yeah, I would say there's at least some truth to that. Either you have to, you know, be able to identify with someone on some level.
Yeah, maybe it just gets down to aesthetics or something.
What about league-wide? Who are you excited for? Who are you liking?
League-wide, you know, the last few years, I've been really good friends with a guy from Colorado, a guy that I teach with, and he's a big Colorado sports fan, so of course the Rockies are part of that. The Rockies weren't around when he was growing up. He was a Pirates fan growing up, but so I pay a little attention to the Rockies, and that's a franchise. I don't even know if they have a plan. I mean, I saw that they just traded for, Brett Anderson today.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. Traded Drew Pomeranz for him, and then, you know, signing Morneau and all the rest of it. I don't know what the game plan is there. When I was out on the West Coast, when I was stationed out there, the Padres were just down the coast, and it was either, you know, I was equidistant between LA and San Diego, so the choice was, do you become a Dodgers fan by proximity? Or I guess I could have been an Angels fan, but, you know, there's no way that I could have followed the Angels after 2002, certainly. And I know that the animosities towards Mike Socha run pretty deep, and I certainly share those. So that was out of the question. So it was the Dodgers and the Padres. And right about that time, Petco Park had opened up, and it's a really nice part of the town. And I like San Diego in general. I don't care for the climate as much, but the town itself is kind of fun, and I like the geography of it. And so going down to Petco was pretty fun. And, you know, that was the Mark Loretta, Brian Giles era of the Padres, where they're actually a fairly decent team. So I'm kind of excited for them to get back to being something other than the doormat of the NL West.
Yeah. And player-wise, see, I love Billy Hamilton, and I watched a fair bit of Puig this last year because I had MLB Premium and I could watch while I was watching Vin Scully.
Yeah.
And, you know, so.
Puig excites me. My wife's grandfather's from Cuba. And, so I kind of have a soft spot for Cuban players because basically, you know, this guy, he's a Cuban-American who's in his mid-80s, and what we basically bonded over was talking about old Cuban League baseball players or old Cuban League teams, and so, you know, somebody like Yasiel Puig is kind of it's something for him and I to talk about, and I like the energy that Puig brings.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the guys that I follow, individual players that I follow are either tied to this fantasy league that I've been in with some family members for probably about 6 years now, guys on that team, or guys in my on my score sheet team. You know, I'm talking like Matt Carpenter. I like sort of his player profile. I liked Pat Evans, Carlos Beltran, but now that he's a Yankee, I have to tone down the like to. I admire what he stands at for as a productive baseball player. But you know, any time somebody puts on those pants, it's like they're anathema. Nolan Arenado is probably the other guy that I'm kind of excited about.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw my attempt at the ballad of Billy Hamilton the other day.
No, was that this week?
Yeah, it's a. How did we get started on that? Somebody was. I'll just look it up. I'm obviously on my laptop. We're Skyping. There was some. Yeah, I was. We got to talking about. Man, I have had the worst memory for like the last 2 days. I couldn't sleep Sunday night, so I get that about once a month or so. I'm just up till 4 a.m. for no good reason, and then
yeah, I go to similar spurts.
So yeah, I've got.
That wasn't on our 300 LTE day, was it?
No, it was. It was. That was. was Sunday afternoon. Let's see. Back after a September call-up, I said that there should be a song called the Ballad of Billy Hamilton, because we were talking about the Puig Destroyer, the thrashcore band.
Mm-hmm.
Will. Yeah, De La Feu is the Puig of the Premier League, and then I joked and said someone needs to start a De La Feu band, and then that got me to the Billy Hamilton. And I tried to make the Beverly Hillbilly song fit. Just one of those goofy little things.
I know some of the words in the sentence that you just said. Premier League and then Billy Hamilton. I marvel at the conversations that you and the Pirate and some other folks have about soccer or, you know, football or whatever we're to call it. But did you get into soccer like in the 90s when it seemed like people all across the United States first kind of, you know, there was like a first mass awakening to, hey, there's this game that's played with a black and white ball that's kicked on the ground?
My experience with soccer started in elementary school. We had one basketball court at recess that I was never good enough to get into the game. We had a, you know, like a king of the court, winner stays. I just couldn't get into the regular rotation. But there's a huge, just a huge open field, and we would just, you know, 20-on-20 soccer. It wasn't organized or anything. Just anybody that wasn't good enough to play basketball went over and just chased a soccer ball around. Never really anything organized. I don't really remember the 94 World Cup at all, which I know a lot of people a couple years older than me, that was really a big moment for them. I do remember the very first MLS Cup. It was 96, and Eddie Pope scored a header on a corner in overtime. They played sudden death at the time. And so they won the title in, it was pouring buckets of rain, and I just remember him scoring a goal, and he was my favorite player until he retired. And then I got out of soccer when we moved to Iowa, because there's no soccer up at my parents' house. They're starting to now, but there wasn't at the time. And then around the 02 World Cup, ESPN made a much better effort of broadcasting the games, even though they were, you know, on at 3 in the morning because of the time difference in Korea. And that really, 02 reignited what I liked about soccer when I was, you know, 4 or 5 years prior. And I've been really excited about the growth of the game over the last 10 or 12 years or so. I'm not one of those guys that's going to, I don't think it's ever going to be, you know, America's pastime in the future, whatever people say is, oh, it's going to be so big. I mean, it's a solid fifth place, maybe fourth, depending on how hockey's doing at the time. But, you know, I'm fine with where soccer is in the States, in terms of where it's come and how the future looks, and as long as it just doesn't overstretch itself, which it's been very careful not to repeat the NASL. But yeah.
So the 96 MLS Cup was that like Minnesota Thunder era, or were they in the NASL?
I don't know much about the Thunder. They are. They're minor league soccer. Yeah.
Oh, that's minor league.
They are now. I don't know. Thunder were never in MLS. I know that much. They've moved around the different levels of the minor leagues in the last couple of years. Okay. There's been a huge restructuring of the U.S. soccer hierarchy. And I don't know where the Thunder ended up. They're a good side. I know they have a really strong following.
I think they play out like Blaine or something like that. I just remember. Let's see, they would have. I think that the earliest that I can remember them is probably a year or 2 years maybe after the Timberwolves started playing, something like that. At least maybe they existed before that, but that seems to me sort of like, you know, the beginning of the Thunder. And I think there was another team before that in Minnesota. Because I think I've seen like something on, maybe it was on Chris Kremer's sports logo site or something like that, and I was like, Minnesota, what? And then, oh, okay, their soccer team.
Oh, okay, the looks like the Thunder folded, and now they're Minnesota United is the current team.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, they're out in Blaine, and they're in the NASL, which in the reshuffle is the second tier. Yeah, it's Division Two. So, it's AAA soccer, essentially.
Okay.
I don't know how the U.S. soccer pyramid's organized anymore. They went through a huge reshuffle in, like, the end of 2011. But it's not dissimilar to baseball. You've got the Major League MLS or MLB, and then, you know, then you've got, looks like the NASL is going to be AAA soccer, and then USL Pro will be AA, and then after that it gets split up down into, you've got your semi-pros and, you know, under-21s and developmental leagues, and it's obviously not as expansive as the baseball hierarchy, but it's roughly the same.
That's a pretty decent model, I mean, as far as, you know, it seems like of all the professional sports leagues, baseball really has the tying a region to a particular level of play thing down fairly well. You know, there are weird shufflings where a city will lose a AAA team and later on they get a AA team, and, you know, people talk about cities as being, you know, it's not a major league city, but it's not a AA city either, or something like that. It seems like if soccer was to pick a organizational structure, it's not a bad one to choose. I mean, it's certainly better than relying on colleges the way that the NFL does.
Yeah, I this is just winging off the top of my head because, you know, I did sports history, but baseball and soccer came into being roughly at the same time. Obviously, one here and one over in the UK, but I wonder if there's something could be looked into about the parallel growth structure, because the U.S. soccer system is based on the U.K. soccer structure. You've got smaller teams building into larger teams. Obviously, Major League Baseball doesn't use a relegation system, but...
Right.
But, you know, both of those systems would have grown, you know, roughly at the same time next to each other. Kind of some sort of a convergent evolution type thing.
Yeah, there's like a pretty interesting comparative history project there to be done.
Yeah.
Comparative and transnational.
And
just to throw a couple of academic buzzwords out there, I'm always here.
Every now and then I get it in my head, I'm going to see if I can't go to Madison because they've got that Selig Endowed Sports History Chair now.
Yeah, that guy's incoming next semester. He'll be here.
Huh? Keep that in my back pocket if I ever decide to continue my studies. How far along are you? You're on PhD track, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in my third year of coursework, PhD track. I'm actually, and this is sort of news that I haven't shared beyond anywhere else, but I'm actually on a year of leave right now. I'm teaching. But I'm on a year of leave from my program. So this is the first time I've said anything about it with anybody outside of Madison. But yeah, so hopefully my family's not listening.
Yeah, well, we can always put a disclaimer out.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, but if you belong to this guy's family, well, don't listen. Wait until Christmas.
Well, I can always put this up after Christmas too. So.
Oh no, it doesn't really matter. That I'm on the site. I've got one brother who knows that I hang out there, but he's in college and has better things to do right now than to go listen to a podcast on a site. He'd better be studying for his finals. Chris Darren, if you're listening to this, I'm gonna I'm gonna pound you if you haven't started studying for finals yet.
Are you liking teaching? How's that going?
I really like teaching. I like teaching better than just about anything that I've ever done. Well, definitely better than anything I've ever done professionally. It's one of the highlights of graduate school, and I'm actually glad that I didn't come in as a funded student. So I've had to, you know, kind of hustle for my living for the last couple of years, semester to semester. But particularly in the fields that I teach in, it's really rewarding, and it makes me feel like I'm, at the end of the day, I go home and I feel like I've accomplished something or added something good to society or added something good to the universe, and it's a feeling you've always had with the other work that I've done. So I like it, and I like the relationships that you develop with students.
Are you teaching anything interesting you feel like sharing? I know you, at one point you were asking us about some sort of jazz project you were doing that was for a, was that for a seminar? Or I think that was last winter, wasn't it? Or am I?
Boy, that's a good question. I might have been asking about, for albums.
It was
album recommendations, or like best albums or something that people like.
No, it was music. Was it Vietnam era music, maybe? Did you do something with that?
Yeah, the class that I teach every autumn is sort of a cultural history of music. Two guys that I teach with are in the stage of book ready for publication that they've been working on now for, I don't know, 8 years or something like that. And the throughput is music. So what they've done is they've had conversations with Vietnam vets all across the spectrum, you know, just regular folks, people who were prominent in the music scene of the 60s who also happened to be veterans, so somebody like Humphrey Joe McDonald, a couple of the guys in Creedence Clearwater Revival had military service, and one of the guys that is writing this book did an oral history of CCR. So they've been falling back on some of that material. But it's never about, they found that when you talk with a Vietnam vet, that particularly with people that aren't willing to say much about their time in Vietnam for whatever reason that they have, you can still get them to engage when you ask a question like, tell me about some piece of music that was significant to you, you know, maybe that you heard on Armed Forces Radio, or that somebody in your unit had a small record player that they played or something like that. You know, just share a memory that's centered around music, and people are really willing to do that, and there's something about the language of music that allows people to talk about an experience that is otherwise painful or something that they don't care to revisit. And it's not so much like a, you know, we're using music to exploit people to tell us things that they don't want to talk about. It's, you know, what's the resonance of this music with people that lived through that era and did different things. So music's a big part of the class. We use novels and memoirs written by Vietnam vets for the course texts. And we also use there's a compendium of contemporary Vietnam journalism that we use as the more historical text. And then we show films. The first year we showed a film every week of the semester, so that was like 13 films. That was absolutely brutal. And we've whittled it down now to about 8. And so we do like a small film festival on Wednesday nights as part of the class. So yeah, we throw a lot at them. And we get a pretty good response. And one of the reasons why we can do that is it's a program. The course is offered through a program that combines different aspects of the liberal arts, and so it's not really rooted in, it has to be a straight-up history, or it has to be straight-up a literature course or anything like that, and it gives us a little freedom of movement. but we still try to keep things historically contextualized and that kind of thing. So we have our last lecture on Thursday. It's going to be that's always a rough one. Today is sort of the fun lecture because we wrap the book that I think probably all of us would say is the favorite of the ones that we assign. It's a book called Gods Go Begging by a Chicano Vietnam vet named Alfredo Bea. Terrific book. And so we wrap that one, and then Thursday is sort of our, we each say our piece. We've got 15 minutes each where, you know, we just offer reflections and that kind of thing, because we team teach it, we team lecture it, the four of us. And so that's what we'll be doing on Thursday.
That sounds interesting. I almost wish I was in school over there, because I took a literature of war class in undergrad. It was not as immersive as that sounds. It was pretty.
It
didn't live up to the potential. I wish it would have been more. But
was it all, you know, literature drawn from the last couple hundred years, or did it go back to?
Oh no, it was
Greek.
Oh no, it wasn't. It wasn't a history course. Was the problem? It was an English lit course. Not really my style, and it usually just devolved into political arguments.
Especially, let's see, when did you graduate from undergrad?
07.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
No wonder that it degenerated into political arguments.
Yeah, it wasn't a. The focus of the class often strayed from what I would have liked, but that's neither here nor there now. Ben.
Yeah, history of war literature class is sort of on the dream list of courses that I, you know, if I was going to stay in academia, that would be one of the dream courses to do, I think. So that it's too bad that your experience wasn't, you know, one that satisfied.
Well, I got a good reading list out of the deal at the very least.
Hey, you know, if you get a good reading list out of it, you know, if the classroom environment is that hot, at least you've got something that you can go back to and say, hey, I want to revisit that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You reading anything for fun these days, or are you just plugging away at your lecture planning?
You know, I've been dipping in and out of a book called Gods of the Steppe. It's by a Russian author named Andrei Galasimov, and I read a book of his actually on the flight back from Russia last summer. It was a little novella, so I was able to read it for like about half of the flight over. And this one just came out in translation, I think this summer or maybe this autumn. So I've been plugging away at that, and it's really taking me far too long for a book. Is, you know, it's only like 250 pages or something like that, but I just haven't been able to squeeze the time out of it. And I've got a couple other things that have been sitting on my shelf and looking at them for a while that I need to get to. Book by Tony, I think the last name is pronounced Judt, some sort of European philosophical history book that he did near the end of his life. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. It was recommended to me by a friend, so I've got that one. And over break, I would like to read some Dostoevsky. That's kind of next on the list. I know the pirate just finished reading, has been going through actually an extended Russian reading phase, and seeing those in the Monday, first Monday book club posts, you know, it's kind of gotten me thinking that, yeah, I need to read that. And I've been wanting to read John Dos Passos' USA trilogy for a while now, so I think I've probably got that one coming up too.
Yeah, I just started Gravity's Rainbow after that was mentioned in the last Friday book club, or Monday book club. A couple other people said they're going to read it, and hopefully we can do one of these discussing the book, but man.
That'd be terrific. I've heard it's hard going at first. Well, it's hard going all the way through, but particularly when you first start out.
Well, I can say I'm farther along than the last time I tried. So, small steps.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But next on my history list. I like to not read too many of one subject in a row. You know, keep it diversified.
Yep.
And I don't dip into fiction as often as I should, so I guess I'm going in head first with Gravity's Rainbow. But
well, there you go.
I'd like to get down to Robert Caro's work.
The Johnson stuff or some of the other stuff?
Well, I would love to read the Johnson stuff. I read one of the samples for Kindle. I go through Kindle samples like you wouldn't believe. The to buy list on my Kindle is far, far too long.
I have the same problem.
Yeah, I liked the Johnson sample I read, but I think I'm going to start with the book on the developer Robert Moses first.
Sure. Yeah.
Since it's just one volume. And get stuck into
Power Broker, right? That's what it's called.
Yeah, Power Broker. Yeah. I'll get stuck into the 4, soon to be 5 volume Johnson work eventually. But I'll start small.
Let's see. He's got I think that 5th volume is supposed to come out in the next year or 2 or something like that.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah.
And
what a labor that has been for him. It probably started out as I think I remember maybe it was supposed to be 3 books or something like that. I know it's taken him longer to write the whole thing than it took Johnson to live it, which is just outrageous and sort of interesting trivia in its own right.
And then I also recently I get the daily Kindle sale email.
Oh yeah, the Kindle daily deals. Yeah.
Yeah, the daily deals.
I just start auto deleting those just because otherwise I'm gonna buy stuff. You know?
Man, I went through Black Friday, Cyber Monday period, and I just too much. I got the who was it? Somebody, I think it might have been Can of Corn, recommended Stardust, the Neil Gaiman work.
Okay, yeah.
And Alan Dulles' Craft of Intelligence was on there for like $2.
Oh, wow, I missed that.
I think that was before Thanksgiving, though. I think it was it was not part of the holiday sales. It might be worth checking and see if it's still in there. But
make myself a note for later.
I've got I bought Native Son was on there for $1.99, like in June. Haven't got to that yet. Stuff like that, and don't even get me started on going through Project Gutenberg. You know.
Oh yeah.
I have like all the Holmeses, and I read almost every Sherlock Holmes back when I was in Prague. On commutes, you know, I've got half an hour subway ride to my next lesson. You can get most of a story done, and definitely on the way there and back.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But
yeah, the things that are set up for it's sort of weird how things that would have been written well before any sort of public transportation like we have now would have been considered. How well they lend themselves to just reading through a short story like that in the span of a commute. You know, I'm 45 minutes out from the campus where we live by bus, which means I don't ride the bus very often because it's about a 20-minute drive in by car. But if I were, you know, 45 minutes is plenty of time to get a couple of solid chapters in on something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to get a lot of reading done for school on the bus in Dublin. It was, you know, half an hour. I can get most of a article, or more often reread the article, make sure it's fresh in my mind for the lecture, because you don't have to read that hard the second or third time through.
Yeah, and you've got your annotations and everything.
Yeah,
you
know, just
jog at you and say, oh yeah, 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 remember this, and yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I got
good cramming, good review for you know, so you don't get. Don't get called out on the spot and have to do the tap dance until you kind of remember what it was that you thought was interesting about something.
Yeah, so yeah, you know as well as I do what that one's like.
So, yeah.
Especially in a history lecture.
Yep, sitting through a history lecture or sitting in a sitting in a grad seminar, and you did the reading after you finished writing papers, and after I finished spending a modicum, all too brief amount of time talking to my wife after I get home or something like that, and then trying to retain something that you read between 11:30 at night and 2:00 in the morning for seminar. I don't miss that aspect of the coursework.
No.
I do miss the conversations. The conversations that happen in the seminar are oftentimes, I think, in some ways more interesting than some of the material that gets assigned. And maybe that's by design, but...
Probably. It helps if you've got the right lecturer leading the discussion, too.
Yeah,
there was one lecture I had I couldn't stand. I hated going to that class. But if you have a great lecturer, one that doesn't get all high and mighty because he wrote the book you're reading, actually cares about your input rather than just assuming he knows it all. That just drove me nuts. I should stop now before I get myself riled up.
Yeah, no need to relive it. Right?
No.
But I was really actually curious about, because I know you're into sports history, and so this is, I mean, it's not a purely academic sports historian question, but the question about the most undervalued twin of our lifetimes. I don't know if you thought about that at all, or if you have someone that you had in mind. I definitely do, and I'm kind of curious. First, if it's the same person, but just kind of curious to think who in the span of our lives has sort of been relegated a little bit to unthought of status, or however we want to put it.
I framed the question when I read it in more of a dollars and cents type thing.
Yeah.
When I was in college, I was more into sports as an argument, discussing whether I thought the trade was good or bad, or this contract is an overpayment, or they got a deal, or something like that. And over the last couple of years, I just don't have the energy to get into those discussions anymore. I watch baseball, I watch the teams I like, I watch the players I like. If they do well, hey, that's great. If they don't, they'll play it again tomorrow. And I very rarely find myself discussing, the value of a player in the way that, Stick or Oobs will, where they will whip out all the sabermetrics and stuff and really try and boil it down. And, it just comes down to a matter of preference. There's no right way or wrong way to take in a ball game. It's just, to each his own has always been, that's been a philosophy that served me well in many areas of life, and baseball is one of them.
An appeal to it that every person brings a unique take on. What's the appeal for you? Is it the narrative, or is it the contest itself, or is it the evaluation and the analysis? Everybody latches on to different parts of that. It becomes a mosaic, right? I mean, very few people are only interested in one facet of things, but everyone seems to have like their primary the primary driver of their interest.
Yeah, and for me, I try not to even anymore make a distinction. Well, I say this, it's a bit of a fine line. A good and bad player, I mean, you can compare them to each other. Obviously Mike Trout is going to be better ball player than, Jason Tyner,
Yeah.
But, people, Jason Tyner sucks, blah, blah, blah. Like, he's...
Tyner might lead Mike Trout in most at-bats at DH.
To me, when someone goes off, this team's awful, they can't do this, they can't do that, I'm like, they're awful on a very relative scale that still makes them thousands of times better at what they're doing than 99% of the population. And it's just the way I see the way I've come around to seeing things lately is just, it's just not worth the aggravation to getting worked up, yelling at the computer that someone sucks or the Twins paid too much for this bum, or that he's still a better ball player than me. And
yeah.
I enjoy watching the game, and just, you know, there's so much else in life that's worth getting worked up over. But so when you said undervalued, I couldn't couch how do I value players anymore? You know, and for me, baseball has become just entertainment, you know. And so, for me to frame the question, it's who do I like to watch play that seems to get a bum rap, I guess.
Sure.
And, you know, someone like, I really liked Ben Revere before he got traded. You know, he wasn't the greatest ball player, but, you know, he was fast, he made great plays most of the time.
Yeah.
I would see him do things and go, holy buckets, there is no way in the world me or anybody I know personally could have done that.
Oh yeah, some of the balls that he would get to or something like that.
You know, so he wasn't, you know, I don't know if the expectations for him were fair or not, but I always felt like people were down on him more than I was, and they didn't value him the same way I did. But I watched him because I would see him catch a ball that nobody should have been able to catch and go, hot damn, that was awesome. And I didn't care that he was only batting 220 or not walking enough or whatever. So that's just how I value players anymore. But
to answer my own question.
Yes, to say, now that that little rant's over, how about you?
Well, I found myself, I said, you know, I really better actually find out if Jason Tyner has more at-bats as a DH than Mike Trout does, and he certainly does, actually. Tyner had 109 at-bats or 121 plate appearances at DH, and Mike Trout so far has 30 at-bats or 41 plate appearances. Oddly enough, Jason Tyner has a higher OPS as a designated hitter than Mike Trout does. Small sample size theater, of course, but... All right.
How does that Mike break Trout down? Does. How do their at-bats break down over, like, 162? Because Tyner's career was just... He had more chances to DH at this point, didn't he?
Well, let's see. Total games... Trout has started 327 games, and Tyner has 321, but I guess that's not fair because he would have come in as a defensive replacement a lot of times. So, plate appearances, Tyner had a little bit, had almost 1,500, and Mike Trout has, so it's 14, wow, it's really close.
That is a lot.
Mike Trout has 1,490 for plate appearances, and Tyner has 1,467.
That's kind of... I would have bet money that Tyner had more plate appearances than Trout. It just seems like he was in the league for longer, but I guess he wasn't always an everyday player, and he was up and down quite a bit. Cups of coffee here and there.
Jason Tyner, 619 OPS as the tiny DH, and Mike Trout, 475.
Hmm.
475.
Oh.
Wow. There's the gold nugget in the entire podcast that we've done right now. It's just finding out that Jason Tyner's been a better DH than Mike Trout.
Well, I'll alert the media.
Yeah, really, right?
But yeah, who did you undervalue, or who did you think was undervalued?
I sort of approached it from the underrated aspect of undervalued, like who contributed significant value but maybe gets lost in the shuffle of other players on that team or other players that have come since then. And my answer, and it's not particularly novel, but it's Shane Mack. Because before Santana, he was the best Rule 5 draft pick that the Twins had ever had, as far as I know. For me, part of the way that I think about a player's value these days is it's sort of stripped from maybe stat-specific analysis or something like that. I tend to really like players that part of their value is tied up in the roster flexibility that they create. You know, so like if you have a guy like Shane Mack who can play all three outfield positions and is a average or above average center fielder, that sort of has a cascading effect on the 25-man roster, because then, you know, for one, you have a pretty spectacular outfield defense if you've got three, like in 1991, Twins basically had three center field caliber outfielders, and probably wasn't a great outfielder by that point anymore, but three guys that have spent significant amount of time playing center field, or were capable of playing center field. When you have three guys like that, and two of them who can hit as well as Puckett and Matt could, you can carry fourth outfielders like Randy Bush and Gene Larkin, because you can slide, even if Mack and Puckett are somehow, you know, out of the same game for whatever reason, you can limp by with Gladden in left field or in center field, and you know, boy, that would be pretty scary defense. But Gladden in center field and Bush in right and Larkin in left, I suppose it could have been done. You know, and so you can carry two first base outfielders. You know, you can, these days, when it's sort of the opposite problem that the Twins have now, you know, where they don't really have a center fielder at the moment. You know, Aaron Hicks will be up again, but Lee Thomas isn't on the roster anymore, right? And I suppose Mastroianni is still around, and if you consider him a starting center fielder, then they have somebody that they can put out there, but you know, they've got all corner guys and guys who should be spending a lot of time at DH.
Yeah,
that's not the problem that they had in 91.
Yeah, I always like the kind of guys that can, you know, play a little bit of anything. Helps the roster. You know, I know a lot of the guys were down on Nick Punto, I think largely because he was overpaid. But I have the philosophy that any player can be the right player for the right place, right price. It's just a matter of finding that. But
and as long as you use them right.
And use them correctly, that's the other thing. But yeah, like
Hocking was a pretty.
Oh, Denny Hocking, yeah, definitely. He
could have been probably a starting anything, but as the 24th guy on your roster, that's a pretty handy guy to have.
Yeah, you know, to yeah. Start here and there when someone needs a day off, but third baseman took a foul ball off the shin yesterday and is swole to the size of a grapefruit. Having a guy like Denny Hocking who can, you don't want him there long term, but play two or three games there while the swelling goes down. Yeah, someone like that was. I'd say they have. I definitely like the value in those kind of guys too.
You know, the really high-end version of that, right, is like Cesar Tovar or something like that, where you've got a guy who can play and has played all the positions in one game, but you've got a guy that you can plug in just about anywhere, and you can also plug in at the top of the order. I mean, that's like ideal territory.
Oh, yeah.
I thought Shane Mack was probably, at least for my lifetime, sort of the guy that he was a key piece in the 91 puzzle, and brought a lot of things to the table that sort of get lost in the shuffle when people think of 91, because they've got, you know, Puckett and Herbeck, obviously, and then Morris and Chili Davis. Like, there were always sort of people that were maybe a little bit more high-profile than Shane Mack ever was. But Shane Mack was just a darn good player. And it's sort of a shame that the strike happened when it did, because, you know, he was having a pretty good career, and then went and spent a couple of years in Japan and really never latched on with anything ever when he came back.
I'll have to definitely look into him more, because, well, I've heard the name, but I looked him up on BR, and his last year with the Twins was 98, which is when I got to Iowa, so I never if I ever saw him play, it would have been for... Well, we moved to Iowa beginning in July and then immediately went to Australia for 2 weeks to visit my uncle who was working down there. So we got back in, you know, August, so I would have had at the most 2 months to see him. So, and I would have been 12, so like as a 12-year-old watching a new team, I'm not going to remember specific players like someone that grew up watching him, or like I can remember the players, you know, from high school and even college, you know. But yeah.
And this sort of gets back to the archetype thing that we talked about before. Like, you saying that you like fourth outfielders and guys who, you know, through really like hard work and a little bit of luck and a little bit of, you know, shrewd roster construction or whatever, find their way, you know, on a big league roster. And I think that sort of had me thinking about Shane Mack falls in that category for me. I guess the slightly less exciting version of Shane Mack that's probably more pertinent to recent baseball is like Randy Winn or something like that. So guys kind of like that who can play all over. Maybe I tend to like guys that are above average defenders who play outfield or catcher or you know, maybe third base or second base, but guys who have like doubles power and decent speed, that's kind of my thing. So maybe that's part of the reason why I thought Shane Mack was kind of the answer for me, but Randy Winn is probably somebody like that, or you know, David DeJesus or somebody like that today is kind of the equivalent of Shane Mack.
And I better correct myself before someone else does it in the comments for me. I didn't bother to scroll down on Shane Mack's page yet. It said his career was 87-98, so I assumed he ended. But his last year with the Twins was actually 94, so there was actually no way I would have ever seen him play.
Yeah, I think he played for the Yomiuri Giants.
Yeah, and then, but his last...
Oakland and Boston or something like
that. And a 97 in Boston and a 98 he split time between Oakland and the Royals, so...
The Royals in 98?
66 games with the Royals, yep. Only 3 with the A's, so...
What? Wow. I don't remember him as a Royal at all.
Traded April 8th to the Royals for Mike McFarland. The A's later sent Greg Hansel to complete the trade. So he was with the A's for, you know, opening day and plus 3 and then gone.
So that was around the same time that Gaetti and Gagne played for the Royals, or...
Let's see what the 98...
Maybe that was right afterwards.
98 Royals roster has... Jeremy Giambi and a young Carlos Beltran made appearances on that team.
Yeah, and probably Johnny Damon was probably...
Yep, Johnny Damon and Jermaine Dye. Terry Pendleton was the main DH. Sal Fasano was the backup catcher.
Him of the spectacular... I wonder if Sal Fasano had a spectacular mustache back then, too.
Well, I'll check Google Images and put it up with the post if he did. But we've got...
Looks like Gagne and Gaetti were a couple years before that.
Oh, Carlos Feblis. I haven't heard that name in years.
Wow.
Tim Belcher pitching?
I hope that people are enjoying this little trip down memory lane of the Twins fans enjoying the 98 Royals.
They can...
Jose Offerman, wow.
They're welcome to hit pause, fast forward, delete, whatever they want if they don't want to listen to this. Well, it's been an hour and a half, and I know you've got lectures coming up this week, so any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
You know, I mean, we covered the real gamut, and we didn't get everything that I thought we would, but it was a really, really enjoyable conversation, and, you know, sort of serendipitous that we could make this happen when we did sort of sandwich right in between busy time and then coming up on Christmas and New Year, so I'm really glad that we could do this, man.
Yeah, I feel like we had we barely started. We could probably put out, you know, another episode or two in the future when you've got a break in your schedule.
We'll save some of this for Will, you know.
Yeah.
We can get Will going, and then we'll just have a whole series of things.
Yeah, might as well go ahead and just spell it out for people. We alluded to it, I don't know, an hour ago, it seems like. But, CH, the Dread Pirate, and I are gonna, once we find a place in our schedules that works for the three of us, we're gonna start a history roundtable. Hopefully, if the first episode goes well, it'll be a recurring feature on WGOM Radio. So, if you want in on that, if you are a history buff, we will, you know, once we get rolling, we'll start taking invitations. If you have a topic you really want to talk about, you know, we'll put up that we're talking about the Crimean War, and if anybody has a super intense interest in it, they'll be welcome to join us. But that is a bridge we will cross well in the future. We still got to get Will on this to begin with. But I personally have big plans to revive the podcasts. So look forward to new things to come. Hopefully, CH, you will be involved in that quite a bit.
Yeah, I'd love to, and coming up here on my grading time, so if this gets posted, you know, relatively soon, I'll be seeing everybody in the comments for sure. It's gonna be a lot of fun.
Alright. Well, thanks for talking with me, and
Scott Layas also on the 98 Royals. I couldn't resist that one last month. There he is. Scrolled on the page.
I think that's a good note to end it on. So
there we go.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will be back with a new episode shortly. WGOM Radio is a production of WGOM.org. Our theme song is titled Bruce Lee by Doran Deutsch. It's used under a Creative Commons license and is available from Free Music Archive at freemusicarchive.org.